thousands and thousands of days these things could run and are run. We talked about, let's see, me and John talked about acceleration. Can we drop it? Acceleration was 60, you know, you could take your car and you stop on the gas and maybe in about 6 to 10 seconds you could be up to 60 miles an hour. Well, to get a change of velocity of 60 miles an hour with the Dawn spacecraft, it takes 4 days. 4 days. So that's why we have a problem with these engines. You know, it sounds good. Oh, ion engines, why can't we use them for liftoff? Well, you're not going to get that kind of power. But collectively, over all the years that this thing is running, the amount of force, because these things shoot the exhaust, I think it's something like 10 times the exhaust of chemical engines or more than that. Over the years, you're going to have the same amount of power that was used by the Delta II rocket to put this thing into space. If you want to believe that, that's unbelievable. Because the thing's never shut off. As far as going into orbit around the two asteroids, Vista and Ceres, the craft turns around and fires this ion engine for days, and that's how it slows itself down. It does have thrusters, I think about a dozen thrusters on board, but just for maneuverability, not for slowing itself down. Let me drop it.
So you believe that it gets into orbit around a asteroid by way of the ion engines doing the reverse thrusting. Is that true, Paul?
Oh, yeah, 100%. It's going to go into orbit around 124 miles above the asteroid and sit there. Not really going to go lower than that, which is actually relatively high. Yeah, the moon, when we orbit that, it's roughly about 60 miles. They choose the 60-mile area. It's going to be 125 miles above the surface of the first asteroid. And then deorbit the same way. It's going to put the thruster on and take off and go to the next asteroid. When it goes into the final asteroid, Ceres, it will be 2015, and it's going to stay in orbit. It's not going to deorbit. There's no plans of deorbiting this thing and going somewhere else. When it leaves the space port, when this thing takes off on board, this craft weighs about 2,000 pounds. Roughly half the weight, roughly 1,000 pounds, a little less than that, is the weight of the fuel being xenon gas. Xenon gas is a heavy, relatively heavy gas on the periodic chart, and that's why they use it. I mean, you could accelerate other types of gases using an ion engine, creating ions, separating the electrons and the protons, and shooting the protons out the back. You could do that with other gases. They choose xenon because it is a heavier gas, so it's better to carry, 1,000 pounds of that instead of, 1,000 pounds of some lighter gas. Drop it. And this 1,000 pounds of fuel is enough to, take it to roughly 2 AU, between the orbits of Mars and Jupiter to go to these asteroids. It's unbelievable. And, and then if you read all the information on the Internet, and they had the one where you click on the video for the animation, and that really is cool. I mean, they do show this thing turning around with the ion engine firing to slow itself down to go into orbit. This big blue engine, the blue tail coming out of the spacecraft. And you were right about the size of the panels for the solar panels, roughly 60 feet long. The spacecraft itself is only about the size of a motorcycle, but the panels are huge relative to the craft. But it needs that power being so far from the sun, inverse square, well, roughly about four times more than what you would get on Earth if it was in orbit around Earth. And so you, to get the same kind of power, you need these panels to be four times bigger than you would have for the same size spacecraft floating around Earth. So it's amazing. So that's the Dawn story, Dick. Back to you.
I have a quick comment. Okay, get you in a second now, Wesley, and that is, I just did a quick calculation. If it takes 0 to 60 in 4 days, a real high-power automobile, I think, can do it in something like 6 seconds, 0 to 60. And the automobile is accelerating at close to 1 G, 9.6 meters per second, so to speak, or 32 feet per second, 1 G is what you can get close to that with a high-power automobile. And the fact that Dawn does that in 4 days means that it has an acceleration of 174 micro-Gs. Pretty small. I am guessing, Paul, that in order to get in orbit around a asteroid, they have to start firing that engine a week ahead of time in reverse. Start slowing it down as you approach that asteroid in order to get in orbit with it. You're firing the engine in the reverse direction, and I'll bet you're firing that engine a long time before you get there, quite a number of days. Did they happen to mention how long before they get to the asteroid do they start doing the reverse thrusting? Over to you, Paul.
I believe I read a month, Dick. It takes like forever. I think it's a month. And then when they go to orbit, they say, you know, it takes a long time to circularize their orbit. So it will be in orbit roughly 6 to 8 months, I think it is. At least 6 months. And before they try to get out of orbit again. So, I'm sure the same is going to hold true when it tries to deorbit. Probably take you a month to get out of orbit. Back to you there.
Question. Now, when you first get in that orbit, you're going to be highly elliptical, and by firing it at just the right times in the orbit, you can circularize that orbit. Okay, Wesley and John in that order. Wesley, go ahead.
Yeah, actually it's not related to the subject we're discussing, but I would like to go to the counter or traverse if you have a little time left of the single side band, as this is the close to the nature of hemorrhage operation, because I believe it's worth the effort. Back to you.
And that is going to be the next subject we're going to discuss. John, go ahead.
Dick, I wonder if possible if Paul saw all three engines firing for the deceleration. Maybe that's why they have three engines, and that's how they're going to be able to decelerate. They would be able to do, I guess, three times the deceleration.
Is that the one time when they might fire more than one engine, Paul? What do you think? Well, maybe they don't have enough solar power to do that.
No, John. It's 100% one engine at a time. That's it. They use them to cycle them. You know, Deep Space One had one ion engine, and they'd run it for months at a time. They shut it off, and they couldn't, you know, bring up another one. They said, boy, if we only had three engines, that would be nice. You could put one on for, you know, a month or two and put the other one on for a month or two. It's that type of thing. It's not a... They never fired, or will fire, one and one at one time. You have the one exhaust, by the way. If you look at the spacecraft, it's just one exhaust, but the three engines are mated together with inside that compartment. Back to you, Dick.
BDH with a question. BDH, go ahead.
I was wondering, it seems that it would be very critical as far as their approach to it, that they're coming into that asteroid relatively slow to be able to be captured. So if they're a little bit off one way, they wouldn't be captured at all, and if they're the other way, it could spiral in. It just seems that because of such a long slowdown process, to be captured and get into that very highly elliptical orbit at first is very critical as to their approach. Go ahead.
Yeah, I don't know your full call letters or name, sir.
Oh, I'm sorry. It's WA2VDH. John, I had the question before about the surge impedance.
Okay, I misheard you as Baker Delta Hotel, Victor Delta Hotel. Very fine, John. You're absolutely right. You've got to aim for just the right point in space. You've got to be slowing down at just the right rate, start the deceleration at just the right time. And Paul is saying they start a month ahead of time. It's got to be a very carefully designed maneuver. Otherwise, like you said, you're going to intercept the target as opposed to getting in orbit around it. And that orbit in the beginning is going to be a highly elliptical orbit, I think. Takes very fancy maneuvering. And then if you're willing to keep burning that engine, you could make the orbit lower and lower and get closer and closer. And then you have to fire the engine the same amount of time to slowly make the orbit larger and larger in order to eventually escape to get back out. So how close you get, how close you get to that particular asteroid for the photography is really a function of how much thrusting you're going to get, you're willing to invest. And what's the lowest part of the orbit, Paul? How close are we going to get to the asteroid to get reasonably high resolution photography? WS2N, K2RIW?
124 miles, and probably the same for Cirrus, but I don't know. I just remember reading the first one, Vista stuff. I would think of Long Island, 125 miles long, roughly, you know, standing on end. So I guess a little higher than the height of a little lower than the International Space Station relative to Earth. But with the cameras they have today, I mean, I'm sure that they'll be able to bring that resolution down to probably the size of a table. Back to you, Dick.
And depending on what optics they're using, 124 miles, which is a very low Earth orbit, it would be a very short duration orbit. With the right kind of photography, you can easily read, you would easily resolve something the size of a newspaper, but they probably don't have that big a camera on board. Did they say what kind of resolution of the surface they might achieve, Paul?
No, I didn't see anything in that regard, so I don't know. But I know, you know, the cameras they got are just fantastic. And a Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, which is about the same height above Mars, that's been in orbit for the last, since 2005, I think. That camera, they call it the high-rise camera, has taken pictures of the spacecraft, you know, the rover is actually sitting on the surface. Took a picture of the Beagle, because Beagle had crashed there by the European Space Agency, found that. It took a live picture of the Phoenix lander coming into land. It showed the parachute attached to the spacecraft as it was coming into the atmosphere. If it's any kind of camera like that, no problem, Dick, you know. Newspapers, maybe the newspaper print, back to you.
As I was mentioning earlier, the guys that are taking these inexpensive charge-coupled device cameras, like the 2UCAM, which is around a $100 device, and properly hooking it up to a good telescope, and sometimes using cryogenic cooling to get a better dark current, they are getting astrophotography pictures in guys' backyards on Long Island that Palomar would have been proud to publish, 15, 20 years ago. Light amplification, very low light level cameras can really do magic these days, way beyond what the Kodak chemistry used to be able to do. Okay, let me drop for a second. And now we're going to get back to Wesley's question with reference to single sideband. I'm going to give a little bit of a preface first. One of the very often asked questions in any technical course on radio is how weak a signal is useful. If I design a better and better receiver, can I design it to receive a weaker and weaker signal so I can get more and more range out of that transmitter and transmitting antenna? And the answer is yes, but with a couple of catches.
All of the wheel again from my head.
Go ahead, Wesley.
Well, I know that you're an educator and to exam, and I really use your help. You are one unique person. Anyhow, as far as the difference between the single side band used in the telephone and the single side band used by ham radio amateurs and the communication is that in the telephone they have never reduced the carrier, and the carrier is realized by the crystal control oscillators just to not lose the phase relation, I would say. And the second thing is that we take the comparison by the way, history reason. I love talking to John because then we can discuss many things from the history. Okay, U.S. Air Force, actually in the system of nuclear bombers, NORAD, N-O-R-A-D, that was something like that. They were, before the satellite communication, they were using single sideband, and it was the only, the reliable communication for the bombers. Now, we take the SSB versus AM, then, well, the carrier is not transmitted on the single sideband, so then we have a reduction of 50%, right, talking roughly 3 dBs. In AM, 100% of modulation, so half of the power is compromised by the carrier, then the remaining half of the power is spread to the both sidebands. So let's calculate. Both in a single sideband, only the sideband is transmitter. We reduce the current to, let's say, 3%, right? Then we have a 50% in transmitter power, and then so it's minus 3 dB plus 3 dB equals 6 dB, if I'm correct. Because only one side is sideband is received. The receiver needs the bandwidth. I mean, the receiver bandwidth that is needed is reduced on another half. So effectively, we have what required part of the transmitter, another 50%. So we're talking minus 3 plus minus 3 plus minus 3 equals 9 dBs. Now, that's what you stated last time was actually the contradiction to the conservation of energy. Because you stated that, all of the benefit is coming from the receiver part. So let's say if we have a saying of the power of the transmitter, but we do not reduce the power of the transmitter, then 9 dBs equals 3 dBs 100 watts, sine 9, there you have a math. At which point I'm wrong, Dick, and to exist.
Yeah, I think I mentioned last week that many of the experts used to say, and maybe the answer has gotten modified slightly recently, used to say that single sideband over amplitude modulation has approximately a 9 decibel advantage in threshold capability. That quote came out of a very respected textbook that was used in American colleges on electrical engineering. The book was published by McGraw-Hill. I think the author is Misha Schwartz, and the book was entitled Information, Transmission, Modulation, and Noise. That's the name of the textbook. And in that textbook, you will find the 9 dB quote. And the way it was explained is that there's a triple advantage. Number one, let me drop. And you've already mentioned these, but I'm just going to slightly reword them. First of all, single sideband requires half the bandwidth of the receiver as opposed to double sideband. That's a 3 dB advantage. Number two, you're no longer transmitting the carrier. I've heard that represent close to 3 dB. I think it's a little bit less. A fully amplitude modulated AM signal. You put 50% of the power into the modulator. If, for instance, I'm building a 100-watt transmitter, I need 50 watts of audio if I'm using high-level modulation of the final tube. So the total sidebands up and down are 50% of the power of the carrier. but we'll make it, well, those two sidebands, upper and lower, are coherent with each other. So if you're using the right kind of a demodulator, I think there's a 3 dB advantage there. And the third advantage is that the carrier itself has to be present in an AM receiver in order to demodulate the carrier, two sidebands. The two sidebands, you could say, are beating against the carrier in order to give you the proper envelope. That if you know what selective fading sounds like on an HF radio, a shortwave radio that's listening to an overseas broadcast. Let me drop. Whenever you're using a shortwave radio to listen to an overseas shortwave broadcast, quite often you'll hear what I describe as a Donald Duck sound. What's really happening is the multipath is creating selective fading. In other words, there's a very sharp notch that slowly walks across your receiver path band made by Mother Nature's multipath. And when that very sharp notch happens to drift through the carrier of the shortwave signal you're listening to, you're now listening to double sideband suppressed carrier, and without putting that carrier back in by a proper reinsertion at the receiver, it sounds like Donald Duck. All voice gets doubled in frequency, and it sounds kind of weird. So you've got to have the carrier to beat against the sidebands in order to get amplitude demodulation in the receiver with the proper envelope. And in the case of a single sideband receiver, the carrier is always there. It's being created by the, you could call it the beat frequency oscillator, that's part of the synchronous demodulator, I think it's called synchronous demodulator, yeah. So the nice thing about the telephone circuit with the accuracy pilot tone is that you have frequency accuracy. If I'm using a high enough quality transmitter and a high enough quality receiver for single sideband reception, I can have all the frequency accuracy that's required. So that becomes a wash if I'm using good enough equipment. So you put it all together, the carrier you're not transmitting, you're putting all of your energy into the information channel. You're only using one information channel, sideband, and you've got a locally injected carrier all together according to that fairly respected textbook, and I could probably find a couple others. I've heard estimates as low as 7 and as high as 12, but I think the average is for properly speech processed single sideband and a properly designed receiver, it has something close to a 9 decibel advantage over double sideband with carrier ordinary amplitude modulation. So that's where that opinion was coming from.
Repeater, timeout.
That's where that opinion was coming from, Alex. N2XJN, K2RIW in the TechNet.
OU2TTT.
TTT, Gordon recognized, but Alex first. Great, Alex.
Oh, I see. Okay, well, actually the 9 dB is not true, because if we assume that we are reducing the power of the transmitter in order to get the same effect that the receiver part. So let's say, okay, we have 2,000 watts of AM, and then we have 250 watts of a single sideband, and we have the same signal. Well, where is the catch? And why I say that I disagree with your statement from last week is that finally we don't reduce the power. Who said we're going to reduce the power? So if we don't reduce the power, but we can reduce the power, then we have another gain of the power. Because then the comparison would be faulty. If you have 100 watts, or let's say 200 watts, of power of the transmitter, and then you reduce the power in order to get the same effect, then fine, the map is okay, but you don't reduce the power. So then you're getting another 9 dB, so it's not really 9 dB, because the stronger signal then allows you, again, out of the receiver filter. So the SNR, which is the signal to noise, is improved as the receiver boundary is reduced. Back to you, back to exam.
The final stage of a transmitter, the final tube that's driving the antenna, usually has a limitation that can be best described as peak envelope power capability. If I use that as a point of comparison, and if I compare the peak envelope power capability of a single sideband transmitter to the average carrier capability of an AM transmitter, The reason I want to use the average carrier capability of an AM transmitter is that during the modulation envelope of AM, you're keeping the average plate voltage constant, but during the peak of modulation, the plate voltage becomes doubled, and on the valley, the voltage on the plate goes to essentially zero. So you're continuously modulating the plate voltage in high-level amplitude modulation, and the average is a possible point of comparison. From that point of view, 100 watts of average power out of an AM transmitter, when it's not transmitting a continuous tone, versus 100 watts of peak envelope power out of a single sideband transmitter, a considerably higher percentage of the transmitted power is the active information being transmitted as opposed to just the dead carrier. The dead carrier is good in that it moves the automatic gain control to the receiver and operates your signal strength indicator. But in theory, except for Morse code operation, the carrier transmits no useful information, is the way it's usually stated. I know Gordon wants to put a couple of words in this, and I know that he's on the road and probably getting out of range, so we better get to him in a hurry. W2, triple tango, K2RIW. Go ahead, Gordon.
WA1 DBA. I heard the WA1 in there, too, so I think you can add him to your list. No, I should be all right for the next half hour or so. Let's put this smartly, and I thought Wesley was on the right track in his original calculation. You know, bottom line is that 25% of your power is used for, you know, the information, the one sideband that you want to recover out of an AM signal. 50% in your carrier, 25% is sitting in the other sideband. That's just a waste of time unless you're doing something funky with it. And so right there you pick up 6 dB of system efficiency. And then, if I remember Shannon's law, pretty much the relevant bandwidth, the difference between an amplitude modulated signal and a single sideband signal on the receive side allows you to pick up another system, again in the system, about another 3 dB, and that's a derivation of 9 dB. I mean, I just wanted to make sure that we spelled it out in what I think are simple terms. If I've oversimplified or made an error, then beat up on me. It's okay. K2RIW, W2TTT.
Well, what I was trying to prove is that from the transmitter part, if you have exactly the same two transmitters, power of the transmitters, then you gain not only 9 dB, is you gain from the transmitter side because you're delivering the same power, but the power is used in the more narrow pattern, like the needle comparing to the nail. So if that statement of yours was true at that point, talking about last week, at that point, there would be violation of the conservation of energy because you say that all of the benefits is on the receiver part. That's what I'm trying to prove, I guess.
No. The way Gordon just described it is one of the methods of analysis. There's always going to be controversy when it comes to comparing sideband to AM. Because in the case of sideband or AM, we can talk about peak envelope power. Well, in the case of the peak envelope power of sideband, during the instant of time the person is not talking, no transmitter power is taking place, and the tube gets a chance to cool off. You can be over-dissipating the tube during the speech peaks, but the speech peaks have a certain crest factor. Human speech has a 23 dB crest factor. In other words, the peak envelope power out of a microphone listening to a human talking is 23 dB higher than the average power. So a single sideband transmitter transmitting nothing but audio gets a whole lot of cooling time. In the case of an AM transmitter, when I stop talking, that final stage is still putting out carrier power and still creating heat. So the heating of the anode of the final tube of the transmitter is a possible point of comparison when you try to compare how much range or sensitivity or advantage I get of an AM transmitter versus a sideband transmitter. So we can talk about average carrier power for AM, we can talk about peak envelope power, we can talk about the average amount of heating power from the plate of the tube. You'll come up with slightly different answers no matter how you do it. I wonder if that's close to what you were saying, Gordon first, and then we'll go over to Wesley second, and then the WA1 third. W2TTT, K2RIW in the TechNet.
I was thinking peak power comparison. Did the whole analysis of the human voice is a whole other game, and I was going to impishly suggest, yeah, like if you used MCW with AM versus MCW on a sideband system, green, green. I don't want to go back there. I'm sorry. K2RIW, W2TTT.
Yeah, the bottom line we're about to find out is it's a difficult comparison because what are you comparing? Total amount of heating or overheating with what time constant of the final tube? Total amount of average power transmitted. Those are different things. So on the transmitter end, you can use different points of reference. On the receiver end, things are relatively easy as far as one bandwidth versus the other. There's roughly a 2-to-1 bandwidth, so there's a 3 dB difference in noise power of the receiver. But there's another factor going on, and that is single sideband injects a beautifully strong carrier with your high-level demodulator that's used what do they call it now? Double sidebands? I can't think of the name of it. It's a kind of a synchronous demodulator, but you're injecting a beautifully strong carrier. With ordinary AM demodulation, the carrier must be transmitted because that's what you're beating against to make the linearity of the envelope. And the way a receiver behaves with a weak carrier in an AM signal, it starts generating a kind of distortion which hurts the communication ability. So there's another couple of factors going on here. Linearity or fidelity of the demodulated audio, and therefore how much speech intelligibility takes place. Properly formed sideband and a properly designed sideband receiver does have additional, let's call it audio punch power, compared to AM under real working conditions. That's a hard one to pin down. N2XJM, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Would blow the top off the 12 dB margin.
Hey. N2XJM. Well, here's the catch. If you compare two transmitters, let's say each one is 100 watts, and then you not only concentrate on the power that is transmitted, but you concentrate on the power that is being used from the energy supply. Then you can, in order for you to compare properly, because the single sideband transmitter has the cooling time, so probably half of the time is being used for cooling, especially when you have a short signal to be sent, like let's say the whatever. And then what's happening is when you calculate the total of power that is being used by an hour, it looks that if you want to have the same power used, then you have to increase the total power, the transmitter of single sideband, to have the same power used of, let's say, another 30-40%. That's where the controversy is, because at that point you're coming to what I stated, 16 times of the benefit. Back to you.
If there was a benefit of 16-to-1, that would be 12 dB. The real limitation, as I see it, once you properly design the modulation, the power supply, and everything else, the real point of comparison, I think, is how much heat can be dissipated by the anode of the final tube. That's where the rubber meets the road in some of the analyses that I've read. To try to keep the average power transmitted that's drawn from the Con Ed power line may not be a fair comparison, because usually the power supply is not the limitation. You've chosen a frequency, you've chosen a tube, 6146 might be your favorite tube, and how much single sideband speech power can I get out of a 6146 in intermittent commercial amateur service or commercial service with reasonable service life of that particular tube? It's a function of how much is the average plate dissipation in the service. And so the power supply is easy. It's the RF transmitting tube that really sets the limitation in some people's minds with some of the write-ups. So if I compare K keeping the heating of the anode of that final tube constant in an AM transmitter versus sideband transmitter, you're going to come up with at least 9, and Wesley is suggesting maybe 12 decibels of advantage of sideband over AM. Is that sort of what you're saying, Wesley? N2XJN, KQRIW in the second end?
I'd agree with that, maybe more.
Yes, that was a right comment. Let me drop. That's why I disagree with the people who say only 9 dBs is absolutely, for me, forcing. We already have the 12 dBs. Look at them up. Okay, reducing the power of 50%, you have a 3 dBs, right? Then let's say we don't reduce the power we have a 2 transmitter at the same so we have another 3 dBs, right? Because we don't reduce it. Now, another factor is that we have by having a higher power, we can narrow the bandwidth of the receiver again. So we have a 2.6, we can go to 2.4. From 2.4, we can go to 0.22. From 2.2 kilohertz, we can go up to 2. And with a higher power, we are able to maintain the readability of the signal. So at that point, we already have another 3. Back to you. So then 3 plus 3 plus 9 is not 12. Back to you.
Okay, we're fairly sure that the total advantage of single sideband over almost every other method of amplitude modulation or angular modulation is going to give you a significant number of decibels of advantage, whether it be 9, 12, or 16, or 12, or 15 dB. We can discuss those details and what you use for the basis of comparison, because the modulation technique is significantly different. The average B-plus voltage you put on the final tube is different in those two services, so the comparison becomes a little difficult. But still, if you really want to get human speech through without using a fancy computer-generated integration techniques, without using I can't think of the name of the mathematics right now. If you really want to discover a really, really weak signal threshold, do a little bit of study of how the global positioning satellite receiver system works. My goodness, can that work with a weak signal? Can you imagine starting off with a signal which is 24 decibels weaker than the noise that's in the bandwidth of your IF strip of that receiver? The IF strip is 1 megacycle wide. Let me drop. The threshold signal that will give you good GPS reception can be 24 decibels weaker than the noise of your receiver. You listen with your earphones into that signal and you'll say nothing is there. And you take that noisy signal and digitize it. You convert it into a string of digital numbers. And then you operate on those digital numbers. And you suck that signal back out of the noise by 30 some odd dB. Wow, is that a system? Really fancy. And so a very well designed system. In theory, you could use that system to transmit very slow speed speech, run it into something like a tape recorder, and after a significant length of time, speed up the tape recorder to play it back and hear a very high signal to noise ratio of speech coming from, let's say, off the moon, if you wanted to. In theory, you could do that.
How is that being done?
Let me first find out. WA1 Victor Delta Alpha, I think it was, wanted to make a comment. Start off with your name, sir, and your comment. KQRIW in the TechNet, my name is Dick. He was a very weak signal, maybe he was mobile, and maybe he got out of range. I think you're asking, how does the GPS receiver do all that? Is that what you're asking? That's not a simple question. Would you like me to teach you how to do brain surgery in 3 minutes? Over to you, Wesley.
No. I said that I know how recovery of the weak signal is being done, and it's very, 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 very simple. It's not a fancy. What you do is you take the signal within the noise of known frequencies, so you're going to know the frequency. Now you're sampling that exact frequency within the noise, and that's how you're cutting all of the noises around, and then you're actually able to amplify whatever is left. Now, with the 10% of that amplification, you're getting a certain amount of modulation. And that's how you recover it. Back to you.
I've heard your words on that transmission, Wesley, and I don't think you've described how a GPS receiver works. You said that because we're digitizing the noise gets averaged out and the signal remains.
As long as you know the known frequency of the signal, you take the signal with the noise within the spectrum, and you just analyze and sample that particular frequency. And it is not only related to the GPS, it is related to any weak signal and recovery of the weak signal. Back to you.
Okay. You're telling me that the digitizing system, knowing the exact frequency, somehow sucks out the signal and rejects the noise. Because the satellite is continuously moving, therefore because of Doppler shift, you don't know the exact frequency when you first decide to line up on that GPS satellite. You don't know the exact frequency. You know the frequency region, and you got signal that is 99.9% noise and the rest is signal. How do you teach that system to reject the noise and accept the signal? How does the signal, how do you teach the receiver to have enough intelligence to say that's noise and that's signal and I'm going to ignore that one because it's noise? How do you teach a receiver to do that? N2XJN, KQLIW.
I know the answer, W2TTT.
Now, Wesley's going to tell us first.
Wow. Okay, N2XJN. Well, the sampling of the hopping signal is being done and the lacking amplifier is being used for that purpose. As long as the amplifier, that lacking amplifier is able to lock on the first few sequences of the signal, it is following the signal. Back to you.
Okay, that's one explanation. Gordon, you tell us how the guys in New Jersey would design it. You got it, Gordon.
I think Wesley hit on it. You look for a training signal at a known predictable, should we say, I'll call them subcarriers, but they're, should we say, spectral bits, if you will, and you can, you know, really, really carefully decode them using very narrow filters, and so you can, that's how you get these things that are ridiculously, you know, in the noise, because for that little bit of spectrum, they're not in the noise. They might pop up, if you will. Because the noise is broadband and somewhat random. So as long as you get enough recovery on the training sequence, you then know where you're supposed to be, and then you start looking in the pattern of the spread spectrum signal for the various, you know, spectral elements and decode them one by one, and then sum them up together to produce the coherent signal you're looking for, hopefully.
Here's the catch. In the total noise, when the amplitude of the signal that's supposed to be recovered is below the noise level, it's almost impossible to recover it. So what they do is the sequences of the data are being put at first, and the amplitude of the signal has to be within the upper 20% of the noise signal. Back to you, Dick.
I strongly disagree. That signal really is 24 dB below the noise of the 1 megacycle wide approximately IF strip. There are no more narrow filters in that demodulation process as far as the hardware is concerned. You are digitizing a signal with approximately 16 bits of amplitude resolution. You're doing it at approximately 1 million samples per second, and you're sampling noise with a signal buried into it 24 dB weaker. There is no training signal, to my knowledge. There is nothing but a 1024-bit long gold code. Each of the 24 signals, each of the 24 satellites has a unique gold code. Each gold code is orthogonal. That means that there is no mixture, even though all 24 satellites are on the exact same frequency, all transmitting on top of each other. QRM of the kazoo, you would think. Because the gold codes are sufficiently gold, that really means that if I'm listening for gold code number 16 and 15 happens to be present, I get no response of any kind. The receiver regenerates. If it knows it wants to listen to satellite number 16, let me drop. The receiver generates locally. What it knows is gold code number 16. It is digitizing that signal coming down from the satellite. It listens to all 1,024 bits of its gold code number 16 and slowly slides in the time domain one gold code versus the other until they correlate. On top of that, each bit of information being transmitted by the satellite is a spread spectrum gold code, 1,032 bits long, and that bit of information is sent 20 times in the row, and you integrate all 20 of those, and you make a decision. That 20 times in a row sequence of 1,024 bits is either a positive bit or a negative bit. After 20 consecutive frames of that, you make a decision. That was a 1 or it's a 0. 50 bits per second, 1,024 bits sent 20 times in a row. And you slowly slide your locally generated gold code versus the one you've really received until you get a correlation. You've got an early gate and a late gate, so to speak, and you, when you finally get the timing set up just right, out pops that signal that you're looking to, and the overall process gives you 30-some-odd decibels of improvement in signal-to-noise ratio. The majority of it is done by back-end processing. I wonder if you've ever heard it explained quite that way. That's my understanding. Gordon first. W2TTT, before you get out of range, K2RIW.
JC2QIQ with a comment.
Yeah, I'll get you in a sec. Yeah, I mean, I think you're right. I mean, my point was that it was being done in software, looking at each slice, and they're looking, as you said, they're basically sliding it up and down in frequency, and they're looking for, they use a redundancy model for correlation. On what they're looking for, in this case, the gold code, as you call it, or as it's called, I think, Wesley was thinking more in terms of the training sequence, but each one is unique, as you said, in the case of GPS. But the point is that you're looking to correlate a known sequence in time, and you're looking to do it, using soft analysis of the spectrum and repetitive correlation, which is fine. And then, as you said, you make a decision as to whether it's a 1 or a 0, blah, 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 and away you go. Once you have that, then you know what the rest of the frame is supposed to be, and you can pull its data down, its timing and position data, and then from there, you can make your calculation as to where your position is, by correlating multiple channels of this stuff. Anyway, back to you, Dick. K2RIW W2TTT.
I think we don't understand each other.
Gordon, what kind of a truck are you driving in? There's some very unique sounds in the background when you drive.
I know. I drive my old E350 XLT. I got it back. It's the one with the blown engine that came back this week with a new engine. My rear frag rattles a bit. It's got all sorts of stuff on it. Right now, not many antennas, but it's got it's an E350 XLT with a 96-inch rack box on the top and all sorts of... it's got five gutter clamp rails, aluminum rails, and a steel platform on the back.
on the back part of the van, up high, upon which I can latch a tower that cranks up and a few other things.
What a unique vehicle. Glenn, you wanted to make a comment. KC2QIQ, K2LIW in the TechNet.
No idea, Dick.
I guess, Dick, the way that I look at that filtering scheme is a little bit different. I guess it's along the same lines, but I guess the way I would describe it is you have a known frequency that you're expecting a signal on, and you're starting off with an analog bandwidth, let's say of 1 meg, and you know that there's going to be a signal in there that you can compare it to. It's just that the noise floor at 1 meg bandwidth is too high. But if you had a digital filter, an FIR, it'll allow you to limit the bandwidth, but you don't know where to limit the bandwidth. So by using FIR sweep, you can basically sweep through the 1 megahertz of bandwidth and have something to compare it to. And when you see a match, whoop, that's where you set the filter. KC2, QIQ.
You're making it sound like you're sliding the frequency. I say they're sliding the time. Yes, there is a slight frequency correction procedure being used.
Frequency and time, one over each other, they're reciprocals.
I'm talking about sliding the timing of the locally generated gold code. That's the main correlation that's required.
Isn't that just an algorithm?
The signal itself is on 1,572 point something megacycles, and it is phase modulated, 1,024 bits at a 1 megacycle rate. So 1 megacycle rate, the phase is either flipping 180 degrees or not flipping 180 degrees for each individual chip of the signal, which is a 1,024-bit long gold code, and you're sliding the timing of the gold code you generated locally versus the one that you've digitized from space across a 1 megacycle bandwidth, looking for that correlation of timing so that you've got, and by the way, whether or not the phase flipping of the gold code is sent right side up or upside down, that makes a digital bit 1 or a digital bit 0. So the majority of what's required is a timing slide of the 1024 chip gold code, not the frequency. The frequency sliding is secondary. The sliding of the timing is the primary in order to give you the post-detection integration. That's one way of looking at it. You might disagree. Over to you, Glenn.
No, I mean, I'm in agreement with you. It's just, as I said, I think the funny part is it's kind of semantics, because depending on how you write the code, whether you call it a gold code or your FIR synchronization, there's a reception signal that you know that you're looking for. You're already on a fixed frequency that you know where it is, and your bandwidth is already set to 1 meg, and you just need an algorithm now to set where, how to limit the bandwidth to get yourself more dynamic range. I mean, if you could do it in an analog state, the variables are just too wide, but if you, as long as the algorithm is there and you have a known signal, and basically you just have a method to seek the signal. But I think that there's more than one way of doing that. It's just me, but Brandon, you stick with what works. KC2, QIQ.
Someone's on this.
One method of operation is you take the 1,024 chips of the 1,024 chip gold code, put it into a shift register that is 1,024 bits long. While that gold code is in that shift register, you compare it bit by bit with the locally generated gold code, because you know you're looking for code number 16. You compare all 1,024 of them simultaneously to make a decision as to whether or not it is or is not correlated as a 1 or a 0, so to speak, in phase or out of phase. That's one way of possibly implementing it. I think it's primarily a timing slide of what's in the shift register versus what's locally generated. Over to you, Glenn.
How many comparisons are you going to make per second?
Well, let me just comment on that first. Yeah, absolutely, Dick. I'm not disagreeing with what you're saying. I'm just kind of pointing out that no matter what's, no matter how you slice it in the end, in order to get more dynamic range, you have to filter to a narrower bandwidth. Now, granted, depending on what method you actually do to do it, you know, certainly there are methods out there for measuring weak signal that have already been proven, and the actual method is detected. But then again, like you're saying too, it depends on the hardware. You know, how much memory do you have available to you? How big is your FIR filter? And I'm sure there's lots of different ways of adjusting it, and as long as you have a reference to measure against and a way to adjust your filter, you can try to, you know, hunt and seek that weak signal out. Back to you, Dick, KC2QAQ.
Yeah, the actual data rate, I'm not sure now, is it 20 bits per second or 50 bits per second? Say again?
50 bits per second.
Therefore, 50 bits per second, that means each individual bit is sent 20 times in the row before you go to the next bit. Is that true?
Yeah, after despreading, as I understand, it comes down to the chip rate of, as you say, 1,024 bits per second, and then it's despread when its correlation is achieved, and after it's correlated and despread, we're down to 50 bits per second, and that's where the improvement, the signal-to-noise ratio improvement comes about.
Okay, the fact that the desired signal, the bit of 1 or 0 during this period of time, is sent 20 times in a row. How do they accomplish the 20-time spectral overlay? Over to you.
It's basically like they do in the CDMA phones. They have, as you said, an early and a late gate, and basically like a, what they call a rake receiver. Basically, the same thing happens, as I understand it, in the CDMA code division multiple access cell phones. Go ahead.
So, from your point of view, and I think you're right, a GPS receiver is primarily a CDMA type transmission system. Is that the way you look at it?
Basically, yeah, because as you said, all satellites are basically on the same frequency. And it's only their pseudo-random noise number, their PRN number, that distinguishes each satellite. Each one has that unique code. So it's multiple transmissions on the same frequency, and the only thing that's uniquely identifying each one is the code. Go ahead.
WCCC queries.
So there are 24 gold codes, and what makes the code gold is that if you compare code number 15 to code number 16, for instance, of the 1,024 bits long of each code, there's never more than one bit of difference if you add up all the ones and all the zeros of each code. But they are thoroughly orthogonal, meaning that the correlation from one code to the other is only one bit out of 1,024. That's very little cross-correlation. Gordon, go ahead.
So on the decoding side, when you're banging the received signal through the shift register and comparing it to your local generated goal code, you said you were going to adjust the timing. So how many comparisons would you make, assuming moving the timing around, per second?
I think your shift register is 1,024 bits long, and you could say you're making 1,024 simultaneous comparisons to make a decision of yes or no. It's either in phase or out of phase between your locally generated code and your code that's in the shift register. I think you're comparing all 1,024 bits simultaneously and saying it's in phase or out of phase. And if the timing of the local generated code is fast or slow, and those chips do not line up, you do not get correlation, you do not get an answer that differs from random noise, so to speak, and you keep sliding it until you get a correlation. That's, I think, part of the process. Who is the other person who is giving us this information, K2LIW?
How often do you slide, I guess is my point. What's the frequency of the slide?
Right now, I don't know. I wonder if somebody does.
I want to clarify something in the general rule of low signal recovery.
Off in the slide.